This is Chi for Yourself. Now, here's Gio.
Hi, and welcome to Chi for Yourself. I'm happy you're with us today, wherever you happen to be in the world at this moment. On today's program, we're going to look at that little voice in our heads, the one we often call the inner critic. Pretty much everyone hears from their inner critic at some point. Our guest today addressed that inner critic and in the process really turned his life around. Mark Coleman was in his late teens, punk rocker with a lot of rage, when he discovered mindfulness meditation. That allowed him to make the inward journey and to better deal with those critical voices he was hearing. Mark Coleman is a meditation teacher, therapist, and the author of Make Peace with Your Mind, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Your Inner Critic. Mark, I know you hear from a lot of people who admit to having the inner critic, but just for the purpose of definition, tell us what we mean when we say the inner critic.
Well, many things, and thank you for having me on the show. The critic is a set of thoughts and beliefs and stories and judgments that we run in our heads. So when I use the word the critic, I mean that bundle of negative thoughts and judgments about ourselves and our value and our worth and how we are in the world, and in some a series of thoughts and messaging voices sometimes that we can hear them in our heads that are basically telling us we're not good enough, not smart enough, not doing anything right.
I want to start off by looking at that time earlier in your life, and especially about how you came to find mindfulness meditation. I believe you were living in London at the time you made that find.
Yeah, I was. I was at college, and I was a punk rocker. Punk was big in the early 80s in London, and I was a pretty unhappy, judgmental, critical young man, and was thinking all the problems and the pain that I was experiencing was because of everything around me, and I hadn't really turned to look at myself, and I stumbled upon a Buddhist meditation center and learned the art of mindfulness meditation, which teaches you about cultivating awareness, self-awareness particularly, in relationship to your own mind. And through doing that, realized that actually so much of my suffering, as is true for most people, is because of the way that we talk to ourselves, the way that we're hard and harsh on ourselves. And so that was a very liberating insight and turning point in my life, because I realized I had to do a lot more work and training with my mind if I wanted to actually be happy and find peace.
Did you ever act out or come close to acting out any of the anger and rage that you had?
Yes, plenty of acting out of the rage. I'm not sure if I want to share that publicly.
You can be more discreet.
Yeah, definitely not against any person particularly, but I was part of a, you know, political, you know, sort of anti-establishment, a bit like the 99% movement. And, you know, there were times where it got a little heated there, for sure, and the rage was definitely strong against the, at that time was the Margaret Thatcher government, which was similar to the Reagan era here.
And you were brought up, and I was, and I'm wondering, how much, if any, of the upbringing did you bring along with you in that rage period?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say, to tease apart all the streams of influence, but, you know, I think the doctrine of original sin in Catholicism is a very damaging teaching in that rather than, you know, telling infants that you're, you know, beautiful or full of love or have Buddha nature or, you know, a whole just as you are, you're told that somehow something's lacking, that you're inferior, that you're less than, that you're unworthy in God's eyes and all of that. And I think that has a very negative impact on our psyche and our sense of self and sense of self-worth. So I think that definitely had an influence in the sense of feeling unworthy in myself. But also, you know, I also have a lot of respect and love for Jesus, and certainly the teachings on love and compassion, I think, really informed my own exploration of that later in my Buddhist practice.
Mm-hmm. And would you call yourself today a political person? Obviously, back in those years, you were very active and very angry, but how has your politics changed?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think because I spent so much time focusing on the inner world and mind training, and the politics took a back seat until November 8th of last year, when, well, no, prior to that, there was less of an impetus for me. In the last few months, I've, as have many colleagues and friends, felt very galvanized to re-engage politically and socially, because we have some, you know, this incoming administration, which is hell-bent on causing a lot of harm ecologically and to the poor and to the marginalized. Yes. So I am re-engaging politically and becoming more active and integrating political action into my spirituality and Buddhist teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the ecology, and you do a lot of outdoors. You spend a lot of time outdoors, and I'm sure you do your walking meditations and things like that. How much of that is a part of your practice? I know you love the outdoors, but how does that come into your practice?
Yeah, I'd say it's very integral. I, you know, since I moved to America in the early 90s, I've taken to the outdoors as my main source of nourishment and rejuvenation, and also spiritual sustenance. I think the earth and the natural world is a sort of primordial teacher for us, and so much wisdom and sense of connection and wonder and mystery and awe and love and healing can happen outdoors. So I make sure I spend, you know, plenty of time every week outside somewhere, walking, meditating, hiking, kayaking, and just feeling that influence of the non-man-made world, because I think we're starved of that in a technology-driven culture. And so, you know, that's why I wrote that. My first book was called Awake in the Wild, mm-hmm. and about how mindfulness can, when we bring that contemplative approach to being outside, then we can have a very profound relationship to the earth.
Yeah, from I believe it was from Awake in the Wild where you coined the phrase nature deficit disorder. And that, I would think, is a really big problem in this frenetic world.
Yeah, it is. And I certainly didn't coin the phrase. That came from Richard Liu. But I think it really summarizes a beautiful... not beautiful, very painful. It summarizes beautifully a painful reality, which is, you know, particularly children, you know, compared to when I grew up, when you grew up, they spend, you know, I forget what the data is, probably only 10% of the time in the outdoors that we did. And so because of the addiction to screens and devices, that people have stopped going outside for the most part. And it's having a very detrimental effect on children in terms of their learning and their connection to the earth and to all kinds of other things that we can get when we spend more time outdoors.
Hmm. Well, it's understandable for someone to feel that the inner critic is an enemy and not out to help us, but the book title calls on us to come to terms with the critic and make peace with it. Talk about why and how we should do that.
Well, that is a long process, and that's why I wrote a book about it, because it's easier said than done, and like many things in life and in our spiritual work, these things take work, they take time, they take practice. And so in the subtitle of the book, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Help Free You from the Inner Critic, so we need to cultivate both of those qualities, and they're qualities that are essential in any life, in any spiritual life. And so we start with mindfulness, which is this basic capacity to be aware, to know ourselves, to know our mind, to be mindful of our thoughts, in particular, becoming present to you can apply a lot of different strategies. So there's a chapter in the book called the Critic Toolkit. And this is a toolkit for, you know, different strategies, including mindfulness, including noticing the judgment, including not giving it attention, not giving it energy. There's also having a sense of humor and lightness around us. You want to have space. We ultimately want to have disinterest with the critic, because the critic is a very old voice that comes from early conditioning and has a very habitual, monotonous, repetitive pattern of focusing on faults and choices and the past. And so the more that we can be aware, the more we can use humor, the more that we can bring inquiry to really assess, is this really accurate? Is this true? Is this a helpful thought? Does it really match reality? I mean, sometimes we need to have a more compassionate stance, because so much of what's coming at us from the critic is very painful. Mm-hmm. So you want to hold that, you know, with some compassion and see that the critic often gets triggered because of vulnerability, and it started to protect us early in our life because we were vulnerable to, say, being judged or rejected by our families. But now it's sort of become obsolete, and we need to find a way to sometimes just say no and stand up, you know, no thank you, have a nice day, like we would to someone who was similarly criticizing us.
Our guest on This Chief for Yourself is Mark Coleman, author of Make Peace with Your Mind: How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Your Inner Critic. You write that the powerful inner critic can take hold as early as age 8, and it's kind of information parents would probably want to know. In your work and travels, have you seen some identifiers that a parent could spot that would make them more in tune with what they're seeing and hearing?
Well, you know, every kid will have a critic. I mean, it's part of what Freud called the superego, which is just, you know, it's a healthy part of the ego structure, I mean, necessary part of our development, as I said. But what happens is when we get overly fixated on that, when we overly believe its messages and try to fit our life into its demands and judgments, then you'll see that the children start to lose that playfulness, spontaneity. They start to get more contracted. They start to be more hard on themselves, less forgiving, more driven. And, you know, one of the pieces I write in the book about relating to children is to be mindful of our language. So, for example, when giving feedback to kids around something that they've done, it's important to use what's called process-centered praise rather than person-centered praise. So, for example, we often hear the words good boy and bad boy, good girl, bad girl. Mm-hmm. And this reinforces a sense of them being good or bad. And, of course, you don't want to have your child being reinforced this notion that they're a bad person. So when little 5-year-old Johnny is having a tantrum and throwing his toast on the floor at breakfast, it's not helpful for him to hear the message, you're a bad boy for doing that. It's more helpful for him to hear the message, Johnny, that's, you know, when you throw your toast on the floor, that's really not helpful. You know, someone has to pick up after you, and it's very impolite. And so you're focusing on the action that needs correcting, not the person. Mm-hmm. So they don't internalize this sense, oh, I'm a bad person. You know, because if you hear that enough, you will. And of course, our brain has a negativity bias. So it takes, you know, somewhere between at least 5 positives to correct a negative. So if we hear that bad boy, bad girl enough, guess what gets internalized? We don't even hear the good boy, good girl, because we're focused on the negative.
Mm-hmm. How we feel about our bodies or parts of our bodies can be, I would think, a little harder since we can actually see and feel something we don't like about them. What should we keep in mind about body image as far as mindfulness and being kinder to ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly, you know, we live in a culture where culture where there's an obsession around beauty and health and looks and skinniness and, you know, a very rigid type of what, you know, a man's body and woman's body should look like. Particularly for women, I think it's very pernicious conditioning. And so, of course, the critic picks that up. The critic basically follows us around and will assess everything that we do, including our body, including how we parent, including how we work or play sport or an instrument or meditate. So we want to be mindful of how much we are listening to the critic. You know, when we stand in front of the mirror in the morning, do we just notice what we think is wrong? Do we notice what's problematic? Do we believe the critic that we're a lesser person for being overweight or too skinny or too tall or too short? Or do we just hear its ranting, go, thank you for your point of view? Because it's important to remember the critic is just a point of view. It's just a perspective. It's not reality. Mm-hmm. And as long as we can remember that, then we're not so beholden to whatever it says.
Well, mindfulness, of course, is an ancient idea, and it has, as you write, a core component in your writing, something we're now calling neuroplasticity. Basically, what we think about is what we bring about. Talk about how mindfulness and neuroplasticity work together.
So the basis of neuroplasticity is, you know, we can change the structure and the function and behavior of the brain by what we pay attention to, by what we do, by what we think. And so in each moment, we have a choice, and we're either strengthening one habit or the other. And so as we become more mindful, we can become more self-aware of our thoughts, and we can begin to ask and reflect, is this a healthy habit or thought stream that I'm thinking? So, for example, you know, perhaps we're focused on fault-finding or nitpicking or looking at people's faults and inadequacies. And if we do that, you know, if we do that long enough, that's the kind of person we become. We become a fault-finding, nitpicking, negative, critical person. Mm-hmm. But we always have the choice to change that. You know, we can, in any moment, we can go, okay, there's the pattern, there's the habit, there's the judgment. Can I see something else? Can I see something that's positive or constructive or healthy or likable in myself, in another person, in a group of people, in the world? So we can, you know, so we're building more positive neural pathways rather than these negative, critical, judgmental ones. And we have that choice moment by moment. We just have to be aware of what we're doing to be able to interrupt the negatively leaning and judgmental habit.
Yeah, it's a fascinating study. Speaking of judgments, when we're judgmental, are we doing kind of the inner critic in reverse, for lack of a better term? We're turning that same voice outward to judge others?
Yeah, I have a chapter in the book called The Swing Door, and it's really the same process that if we practice judging ourselves, most likely when we're around other people, we'll judge other people. Or similarly, if we're out, you know, we spend our time judging others when we're home alone, there's no one else to judge, so we'll judge ourselves. So either way, we just want to be mindful, moment by moment, what habit of mind are we strengthening? Are we strengthening a critical, negative, judgmental habit? Or are we strengthening a habit that's more kinder, more caring, more forgiving, more compassionate? So, and each of us has to ask that question all the time, because, you know, culturally, there's a lot of emphasis or orientation towards fault finding. You know, just look at the magazines and the media, you know, very negatively oriented. Yeah. We have a negatively oriented brain, as I mentioned earlier. So we have to counteract that tendency with focusing on what's good, what's positive, what's right, what's healthy, etc.
One last question, and we'll wrap it up. You obviously have a very calming way of working with these concepts. Could you leave us with advice or takeaway points to remember as we start to reconsider this thing called the inner voice?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the good news is change is possible. You know, neuroplasticity is, you know, neuroscience's way of saying change is possible. And that through mindfulness and compassion, with bringing awareness to ourselves and our thoughts and our judgments, we can actually learn to see them, recognize them, unhook from them, and actually find much greater peace of mind. And we also have to remember to be kind and compassionate with ourselves, because we didn't ask for the critic to be there. We didn't necessarily do much to do it for it to be there. But since we have it and it's painful, we also need to be kind and forgiving and caring with ourselves for these painful habits that we've developed.
Your website is markcoleman.org. That's Mark with M-A-R-K is the spelling, markcoleman.org. We can find out more about the book there and all of your work, correct?
Yes, yes, markcoleman.org is a good place to find out about my nature-based work, my meditation retreats, my books and audios and all kinds of other interesting meditation teaching events and things.
Well, this book is Make Peace with Your Mind, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Free You from Your Inner Critic, from our guest, Mark Coleman. Mark, thanks for doing the interview and for a book that really shows us many clear and doable ways to bring ourselves much-needed compassion. Please come back and visit us again.
Thank you. Happy to be on your show.
We'll have a link to Mark Coleman's website at chiefforyourself.com. You'll see some changes to the website, always meant to make your visit more enjoyable and informative. Of course, you're always encouraged to leave your email address in the box provided at the top of the homepage or start page. That way you'll get the Genuline's blog posts with guest information and freebies and content to help you live more consciously. Well, that's it for now. Thank you very much for being with us today and for all your support. Be well, and I'll talk to you soon.